It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joe Loss.
We are all here, although that didn't sound really great to me.
I promise there. He's actually right there.
I'm right here.
Oh, you mean Killer Joey is here? You talk about a takedown.
I know. I was going to say. That was 2 weeks in a row that he went after someone and...
And boom, boom.
That guy's gone.
Yeah.
All right. I know that nobody out there understands a word we've just said.
Right.
Which means you have to keep listening.
Yeah.
Because we're going to find out exactly what all that meant real soon. Might be in the second segment. You never know. Depends how things go. Let's just say the boy's carrying a lot of influence lately in the financial world. So, that said, I'd like to welcome everybody back, all the regulars. You know the rules. You keep listening. We keep showing up, and everybody's happy. If you're new to the show and you found it by accident or somebody told you about it or whatever, try to stick around for the whole hour. We always promise you'll learn something along the way. Today, I'll double down on that promise. I have come to play today. Lots of information and some color on the side. In fact, I've already warned a few people to be ready because people are just not on top of everything.
Yeah, I have no idea what's coming, but you were coming around with some spice before the show started.
You did come in hot this morning.
I'm excited to find out what that is.
Telling nobody how, why, what, or where.
he definitely woke up and chose violence.
Yeah, it feels that way.
Well, you know, if you're looking for something to complain about these days, you don't have to look very far.
Nope.
Level of stupidity and so on are always there. Anyway, I digress, as I am so wont to do, and we'll get into it. We will have a trivia question again, as always, at the beginning of the second segment. And in the meantime, this was a week that did not feel good to me, and I put some numbers together, and I was kind of pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, it was a volatile week for sure. It actually ended a bit higher. I also did not expect that. I knew it wasn't going to be a total disaster because the first part of the week was pretty good. But especially if two out of the three indexes were up. The Dow and the S&P saw small gains, 0.3 and 0.1%. The NASDAQ was down just 0.5%. So really, not bad considering everything that happened. Thursday was just such a bad day. It felt awful. It kind of erased our memory of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yeah, that was the problem. It was sequencing. If it started bad, got better, I would have felt
exactly
a lot better, even though the numbers would be exactly the same.
So it really felt like a much uglier week than it was. But the whole trading pattern was just, there was nothing that caused Thursday. I kept looking, and I couldn't find a single event to point to. It was just kind of everyone decided to risk off on Thursday, and they risked off in a big way on everything.
Well, I'll tell you what it was. They all of a sudden discovered that the world was unaffordable.
Okay.
That's it.
All right.
That's all it takes.
Well, especially when your Bitcoin hits a bear market, it becomes even more unaffordable. So that's what actually happened this week. And that's something that actually happens pretty often. I went back and checked the chart. The 20% drawdowns on Bitcoin are like semi-annual events. It's it's not like a large cap dividend stock. It is it trades a lot more like a very volatile small cap stock. And so those drawdowns, they tend to last a bit longer than the bull markets in Bitcoin. So the average on a drawdown on a bear market is 70 days, and the average bull market for Bitcoin is 40 days. Wow. That's it.
That's so the complete opposite of the equity markets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right? If you look at one of those charts that shows bulls and bear markets, it's like 80% bull, 20% bear.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
I think that the market goes up 70 or 75% of days, trading days.
Yep.
Yeah.
Not Bitcoin.
The other thing is in Bitcoin that you can see is that in the equity market, they always say it takes the elevator down and the escalator up. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily true on Bitcoin. It can take the elevator up too. It's just really, really volatile. And that's what happens when there's literally nothing backing the value except a bunch of people saying, yeah, this has value. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. There are lots of examples of that in life, like fine art, but at the same time, it makes it a lot harder to put a true value on something when you can't run a discounted cash flow model and say, right, this is what the future earnings are going to be worth to me today. So just kind of keep that in mind if you're a Bitcoin investor, that you're going to have to suffer through these bouts of volatility. It's not going to be fun. Could it be a buying opportunity? If you're a long-term bull on it, then sure, why not? But I still don't understand how people agree on a value of Bitcoin. I just don't get it.
The phrase that they use in the Bitcoin community is diamond hands.
What does that mean?
And that just means you don't sell during these long bear periods.
Okay.
That's not a recommendation. That's just what they say.
Yeah. That sounds like the Bitcoin community.
How about if you don't ever buy?
Then you don't have to sell either.
Then in a way, you still have diamond hands.
I have never, I have never missed an up or a down ever.
Steve has never sold Bitcoin.
Yep. Not once.
He's got diamond hands.
Gold and silver is another asset that seemed to only go up until this past week or two. A lot of pressure on the prices of those two precious metals. Definitely lost some momentum recently. So we'll see what happens with that. Pretty lofty in the price side of things right now. So
we've been calling that for quite some time now. While it's been trickling upward, and I've been feeling like we might get proven wrong, but you know, if you look at the history of gold and silver, you're not going to be proven wrong. It's going to be volatile.
It's a commodity, of course. It's
when it
be
goes
volatile.
Down, it goes down, and then and only then should you look at beefing it up. In my opinion, that's just me.
Exactly. In somewhat better news, oil is also in a downtrend. I know that's not great for oil investors, but it certainly is great for people who drive cars. There was some concern this week because there was news of a Ukrainian attack on a Russian port. And the thought was that if they did enough damage to that port, then that would disrupt some of the oil supply chain. Doesn't seem to be even a blip in the price, really, of oil. I think it's back down under 60 now, and it's in a pretty solid downtrend. OPEC has been signaling slowing down production. That's due to an expected surge in inventories next year, which should also be good for prices. So if you drive and you like to buy gas, that's you're probably pretty happy to hear all of that news. Earnings season's coming to a close.
You don't have to like to buy gas. You have to buy gas.
Well, yeah, I guess. Yeah, whatever.
Well, you have to like it more when you buy cheaper gas. But again, I digress.
Yeah, I'd rather pay $2 than $4.
And it looks like you might be doing that before too much
longer. Yeah, it's possible. Mm-hmm. Like I said, earnings season coming to a close. Just a few retailers yet to report. And then one big one, NVIDIA. That's next week. So all eyes will be on NVIDIA this week. Let's keep our fingers crossed that they have a good report, because a bad report could really set us up for a not great action in the market next week.
Yeah, NASDAQ's kind of teetering, wondering which way to go.
Yep.
The things that were so hot are losing their luster right at the moment. It's nothing I would worry about, because tech is where it's at in the long run. All right, we've got to take a quick break and pay some bills. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
And I remind everyone that the lines are open, 904-222-8255, and you can use that to either take a shot at the trivia question I'm about to give out, or you can just call in and tell us you want to talk about a certain topic. I will be getting into mortgages probably in the second half of the show, because there's a lot going on in that arena right now.
I think you just refied into a 50-year.
Yeah, well, it was such a deal.
At your age, it makes total sense. Why not?
We'll get there in a few minutes. Anyway, I want to talk about mortgages in the real estate market. Of the entire value of residential real estate in this country, what percentage of it is owned free and clear, meaning it doesn't have a mortgage on it? The percentage of unmortgaged residential real estate in this country. It's just a percentage, which means it's between 1 and 100.
I want to say it's at a recent high or all-time high. Something like that.
And it should surprise no one when you think about what's been going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. For houses have been snapped up for cash.
Yeah.
And it can be corporate, it can be individuals. It doesn't matter. People are buying with cash. So you're right. The percentage of mortgages.
I don't know the answer. I just read something recently that said that was a trend.
And you got to be, plus or minus a half of a point. It doesn't say Bob on my screen, but Bet it is. Yes, it is. It says the farm. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I'm out here waiting on my free government grocery store and bus transportation.
You're not holding your breath, though, are you?
Yeah, I got to hold my breath. Yeah. Hey, quick question for you guys. Our family is scattered all over the United States, our immediate family. And as we're getting older, how important is it for you to bring people in, and not in terms of succession, but in terms of planning, and have them see what you're doing with us? You know, at some point, we're all going to depart. And as we're getting older, I thought maybe I'd try to schedule something where I could bring our children in that are going to be succeeding us, and see, you know, what they're doing, have a peek at what we're doing. It's kind of hard to explain that over the phone. I don't know if you guys ever do that. I don't know how important you consider it. I was just interested in having your thoughts on it, and maybe calling and scheduling something.
The most experienced person about that kind of thing sitting at this table is Adam. So
yeah.
I'd say, why don't you address it?
Yeah, we have a lot of clients that are multi-generational. That usually starts with the older generation, but they often feel like you do and want to get their kids more involved, and eventually maybe even the grandkids more involved. And we strongly encourage that. I think more families need to be open about money, because many, many times the burden of care will fall on another generation, especially on kids as adults age, if they haven't saved enough, or if they just don't have anyone else to take care of them, that where else is it going to go to but the kids? So knowing the financial situation of your parents is actually quite important if you're trying to plan out your own retirement and later life. Because if you have a situation where you need to be financially responsible for your parents, or at least assist them, that should be accounted for. And it very often is not. So it can really blow up a financial plan too for people that haven't done that kind of thing.
I think it's the nicest.
I'm talking to our daughter about, you know, our trying to clue her in as to where we're at. And she said, you know, Dad, that would be really, that would relieve a lot of stress for me. So I'll have to call and schedule something.
You know, Bob, I think it's the nicest thing that the older generation can do for whoever they've chosen to be their financial power of attorney. Because what can happen is, in an extended care scenario, that child who's spending all this time and effort, you know, taking care of the parents, trying to do the right thing, if they have siblings, you know, there may be a lot of money that's being expended on this care issue, this extended long-term care issue. And if the other siblings didn't know what the starting point was, and that door hasn't been open to having conversations, by the end of the whole thing, those siblings can look at the amount of money that's left in the estate that they're getting, and then make all kinds of accusations at the financial power of attorney child.
I never thought about that. Yeah, that's a good point.
It's just unfortunate, you know, what money can do to families, even the best families. And I think transparency is the ultimate tool to keep bad things from happening.
Yeah, I've been reporting for a long time that nationally the numbers don't change much. It's about 80% of parents would like their kids to get more involved, and about 80% of kids would like to get involved with their parents, and nobody will say anything.
Yep.
You can't break that ice. But let me tell you from the producer side how I see this. Right here from ThinkAdvisor in the not-too-distant past, it says 81% of wealth inheritors say they'll fire their parents' advisor. What would that do to the three of us? Nothing good. So what's one of the greatest preventatives? Get them all together with you and make a transition beginning right now so that they understand that you're there for your, meaning us three, we are there for the simple reason that their parents trust us, we know what's going on, and we can help them with the transition to the kids. And that transition is going to be somewhere north of $7 and possibly up to $17 trillion as baby boomers die. This is really an important issue, and I'm really glad that you brought it up.
Well, I was just, you know, sitting and thinking, and I have time on my hands here. you know, at this time of year, everything's browned out. So, but I'll call and make some appointments. I'll take a swag at your homes that don't have a mortgage. I'd say 34%.
Fortunately, you're low.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, that is good news.
I set a low bar, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I appreciate it. You know, we have so many kids' accounts. We'll tell you more about it when you're actually in the office. But you would be absolutely amazed at how often this is happening now. And I do think part of it is because our clients are getting older. And they're seeing their kids grow up and have their own families. And their accounts are getting pretty sizable because of the market and so on. So, it's a very timely topic, and it can be good for everybody. That's important.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Have a great day, and I'll call and make an appointment. Thanks,
Bob. Yeah, I hadn't been thinking about that a lot lately, but we have a few people that are really getting into it. I give them a lot of credit. If you're worried about your kids ripping you off, you should probably worry about it more if you don't tell them what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's actually been a bit of a theme in our business this year. We've had tons of grandkids and kids open accounts and start saving. A lot of these kids, too, the crazy thing about minimum wage growth is that these high school kids are the ones who are affected. And so they're making 13 to 25 bucks an hour, and they don't have any expenses. So now they're like, what do I do with all this cash? And they're actually putting it in the market. So good for them.
Those are fun conversations, too, because I mean, we had one yesterday, mm-hmm. and you had one. I did, eavesdropping, yeah. And it was, we just blow past saying something like Roth IRA, and they're like, "Well, wait, what is that?"
Yeah,
and you're like,
yeah.
"Oh my, well, this is the beginning."
Yeah,
like, and then you smile and give them the answer.
Exactly, and the young man I was talking to, he said yes when I first said it, and then after I was like, "Okay, is there, does that sound like a good plan?" He's like, okay, I didn't understand any of that.
What did I agree to? Yeah, exactly.
There is no shame in that, people.
Right. Yeah.
You know, back when I was in grade school and high school, we took some version of, I would call it balance your checkbook math. But finance, no. The stock market back then was for rich people. Merrill Lynch was charging you $340 to make a trade.
Exactly.
And the market wasn't that high. But anyway, it is a far different cry today. And I really believe that we dropped the ball. That's why I continually on the show will congratulate our governor, who has put finance and investing back into the schools again.
I don't think it's actually happened yet, but it is slated to happen.
Okay. Yeah, and more states are going to pick up on this. And you're going to understand, as this happens, how good it is for people. I have a related article to the one I was just quoting. New advisors are in short supply as 72% of trainees in our business fail. They're weak on the basics like mathematics and concepts. So I'm never going to stop saying this until I'm in the ground. If you are a young person wondering what to do with your life and you like three things, people, money, and math, this is a great career. And if you live in a place that's hot and humid and all that, it's an indoor career. I think that counts because I don't like all that stuff. I never did either. But if you want something to do where you can help people, you can get to know people really well, and just generally do yourself a favor while you're doing other people a favor, because I promise you, the more you advise other people, the better off you'll be investing your own money, and you'll understand more. But think about it. You know, it now, like Joey, you got a degree in it, right?
Yeah.
When I was getting into this business 24 years ago, there were some online courses, but you really couldn't just go to college, get a degree in financial planning unless you were very, very fortunate as to where you lived. Now they're pretty much everywhere, and that's really what it takes to get started.
Still not everywhere, but fortunately right here at UNF, you can get a degree in financial planning.
Yeah, I think that's just a really, really good start. But if you're going to go into it, then I strongly suggest that you start young learning some things. And I think that's maybe what Florida schools are going to start leading our kids to. So it can only get better. But imagine that, you know, if your clients start dying and a lot of them are older, you're going to lose most of that kid's business. Not good enough for me, so we've got to do something about it. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
And I remind everybody the lines are open, 904-222-8255, where you can take a shot at the answer to this question. What percentage of America's residential real estate is unmortgaged? And we know it's higher than 34%. I had a quick note about the market. Some of what's going on with this little bubble bursting, or at least appearing to in some of the more tenuous spots in the market. There's a stock called SMR, which is a small company that is building little nuke plants, you know, the kinds that are going in by the data centers and so on. And they, of course, became a hot topic when everybody started talking about building these things, because we know the grid's not big enough right now. And they have technology now to make the small ones localized. So it dropped back 40% this week, and everybody's pulling their hair out. So I dug a little deeper. It had been up 1,100%. And it pulled back 40%, which means that had you put $100 into it as this run-up started, which wasn't that long ago, you would today have $660, and I, for one, will not cry for you. And that's the truth.
Yeah, 40% pullback does hurt regardless.
It does. Yeah. But their first revenues that are even going to be worth reporting will be in 2029.
Hmm.
Now, you want to buy something that's speculative? You be my guest.
Yeah, I wonder when profitability is forecasted.
Yeah, and I will not be suggesting that you're doing something brilliant, just in case you ask.
So I think we need to tell who Joey took down.
The man is about to speak.
Yeah, so last week we were riffing on Michael Burry because he was taking... Yeah, every couple of years, I think I ran through five different scenarios where he predicted, you know, Armageddon-like market crashes. And then
the one he got right was big.
Right. The one he started with that built his name was in 2008. He talked about the housing crisis. He took a massive short position. The rest is history. He made hundreds of millions on that trade, went on to become, in the American public, a very well-known name, and then had a movie made about him, I think.
Based on the book of the same name.
Right, called The Big Short. I think Steve Carell played him.
Which
is that's a big mark in a career.
Oh, yeah.
If you get Steve Carell to play.
For sure.
Yeah, no kidding.
The problem is, after that, he made about six or seven predictions of major recessions that just didn't happen. And so every year, it feels like we see big headlines where Michael Burry, the guy who made hundreds of millions of dollars back in 2008, says, fill in the blank about how bad the market's going to be. And it's just sensationalism. And so we were joking about that last week and kind of walked through history.
And the week before, too, because I was here and you brought it up the week
before.
Oh,
did I?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, news got out and he deregistered his SEC firm this week, which could mean one of two things. One, it looks like he's shutting down. He said some things that make it sound like he's shutting down. The other thing is, in March of this year, he filed papers that show regulatory assets of $155 million. Which, if you're over $100 million, that's when you register with the SEC. So either he lost money to pull him below $100 million, or he's shutting down. Neither of which sounds great.
That, and also, surprisingly small hedge fund. I mean, $155 million is nothing.
That is not very big. I mean,
that's tiny.
I know of a firm that's bigger.
I do, too.
I'm going to say that.
In fact, I think you all own one.
Yeah, that might be true. Yeah. So that's crazy that... for the amount of press he got, you would think he had several billion under management, minimum.
Well, it shows you the power of just one man on one radio show, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I would strongly suggest that maybe those two things aren't related, but it sure is fun to talk about. So
crazy.
All right, people. I've had it with all of you. You are absolutely nuts. Donald Trump suggests, as one of his many, many points of trying to make this world more affordable, that we should look into a 50-year mortgage, and hair gets pulled out from D.C. to Wall Street to everywhere else, and I'm sick of it. You people are not thinking straight. First off, if a 50-year mortgage is approved, it doesn't mean that everybody has to take one. That is nowhere in the cards. The people who say, well, what we don't need is a 50, we need a 20-year mortgage. Well, you can get one. Now, if you just think about those two things and add in, you got the ARMs, 1, 3, 7, whatever, and you've got 10-year, 15-year, 30-year. The world of purchasing some asset like that and financing it is about choice. What fits you? Because you don't like it, that doesn't mean other people shouldn't get it. So who are you to, and you've seen it all over the media, who are you to say absolutely not? They're going to be paying twice as much for their house. Okay, let me ask a few dumb questions. What's the average duration of a mortgage in real life? How long does it last before it's either refied or the place is sold or whatever?
Do you want a real answer? Because I have one.
Yeah, what is it?
7 years.
Yep. If you take a 50-year mortgage and get rid of it in 7 years, have you damaged yourself? Have you damaged
the
financial system?
You did yourself, yes. So I was looking at all this data about the 50-year mortgage. So if you had a 30-year mortgage at like something like 6.5% and you owned it for 10 years and left the home, the amount of equity that you would have through the principal portion of your payments through the 10 years would be about 16% on the home. On a 50-year mortgage over that 10-year period, you'd have about 4.
And I'm going to tell you why that is 100% irrelevant.
Okay.
Ready? Where is equity build up in your home? Is it in your monthly payment or is it over time?
Well, in that 7 years, it is generally through appreciation, not through equity payment.
Yeah. It doubled under Joe Biden. What is the opportunity cost of not taking a 50-year mortgage if you can't afford a different one? Years and years until you get your ability to get a different mortgage. Why not? But I'm not done.
Me neither.
I happen to have numbers that I did myself this morning. I took a mortgage calculator, and it defaulted to 6.367%, which I assume is somewhere around the market rate.
Yeah, that seems about right.
More or less up to date. Their default was a $400,000 30-year mortgage, and I looked at those numbers. It's $1,995 a month. I went down to a 50-year mortgage, and it's $1,771 a month. Now, you know and I know that if you're $5 short on your cash flow, no banker's going to give you a mortgage these days because they're all regulated by the same bunch of idiots and they can't make exceptions for anybody. So let's say that $200 makes the difference between you buying and not.
You price this on a what? How many year?
50. Same.
But you didn't change the interest rate? That's not accurate then.
I'm getting there.
I think the point stands.
Yeah, your point is well taken. Okay. Although between 30 and 50, I don't think you're going to get much of a change.
I don't know.
But that's personal, my opinion. So it's $200 a month, and it gets you into a mortgage. All right, after 10 years, the 30-year, you owe $270. And after that same 10 years, you owe $307. Well, $37 sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? But wait. You just spent 10 years of your life paying $200 less a month. That makes up 27 out of the $37,000.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not even important. What's important is you have 10 years where you wouldn't otherwise be in an appreciating asset. After 10 years, the paltry little pay down that you've done is going to pale next to the appreciation of the house. So let's recap here. It's not that big a deal. It's a choice. You don't have to do it. Why do you all not want some kid to be able to do this just to get into a house.
Okay.
I think you're short-sighted and somewhere around mean and awful. So
I can handle that because I'm not a big fan of the 50. And here's why. What happens every time in history when access to borrow to lended funds increases? What happens
you're
to the
going
prices?
To have some, there will be some imputed appreciation in home value.
Right.
Absolutely.
So suddenly we have
that.
A surplus of competition at the $400,000 house level because all these people who couldn't get mortgages now can. What happens to price? It just goes up. So will we see 100% of what you're talking about? No, and I don't think you were saying that, but I think that's worth acknowledging is that there's going to be price movement because every time the supply of funds increases.
A lot of the things I've read from all the naysayers say it's absolutely insignificant what this would do to help people get into houses. Then at the end of the article it says, and by the way, with all those new people coming into the market, you're going to stimulate an increase in prices of houses. Well, which way is it, guys? Is it important? Is it not important? Is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? And who do you think you are to tell a young kid that he can't do that in a country where we use choice as our hallmark?
There are regulations on everything involved in finance. That is not
the regulations
out of
on the
bounds
50.
To tell people that they can't take, like you can't take a 20-year car loan. I mean, why not? Because it doesn't make sense.
10 years
to me, this is similar to FEMA to me, because like you were incentive. Like, why do people feel like they can't buy homes? Because they don't want to buy homes where they can afford them.
That's
there are
true.
So many nice places in the country you can live that people don't want to buy the homes that are totally affordable.
I agree with that.
And FEMA does the same thing. It's sort of incentivizing people with a backstop to live in some place where they're at high risk.
The
public takes on
the biggest problem with this whole thing, aside from people thinking they can make rules for everybody in the world, biggest one is if you're not in current ownership of a house, you are missing the biggest wealth builder, period. So do everything you can to get in. That's my view, and I promised it. We'll be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I'm Joey Loss.
And I don't want anybody to think I'm a big bad ogre on this thing, but I'm going to throw out one statistic, and I want you all to think about it. And that's over and above. You're all acting like a bunch of, communists? I use that term loosely because of New York and Seattle. Anyway, the average first-time home buyer right now is 40 years old. It used to be 25. I bought a house when I was 24, actually, so I was pretty close to the old average. By shifting that 25 up to 40, you've got a whole generation of kids who are not getting 15 years of appreciation on the biggest wealth builder they're probably ever going to have. That opportunity cost will cost society big time, and it'll cost a lot of individuals a chance at a brighter future. That's my beef. And that's it. So you guys want to talk about something fun now? Your choice.
I thought it was a great conversation. And I respect your position. I still hold mine. And it's mostly because I think the issue is in the supply of housing. But also, I'm 33, so I feel like I can, kind of dunk on my generation. Our expectation, like when we do this game where we say, oh, my parents bought a house for $27,000 and, or my grandparents or whatever. It's not an apples to apples comparison. First of all, what the technology in a home today is worlds above. This is the same thing with cars, right? It's like cars almost have too much technology. We've talked about the price being out of control. And so I think if people were willing to live in the kinds of places our grandparents lived, you can certainly buy a house at a good price with a 30-year mortgage and all these things.
Yep.
I think the issue is twofold. We've got a supply of housing problem. That is true. And then the second issue is the expectations for what we want out of our first house are also a little bit unrealistic. And so maybe there's room for a 50-year mortgage and that can help in the short term. But I'm a big believer in what historical economics says, and I just think that the price impact is going to be a big counter to what the short-term benefit might seem like.
We had a lot of change during COVID as to consumer preference too. Bigger and better equipped was in.
Yeah,
right.
I have a pretty interesting data point. I just went back and looked up my first house. I originally, when I moved to West Palm Beach, I wanted to buy a house. I'd moved there for a job. I had a budget. I quickly learned that that budget wasn't going to work. So I upped my budget and got a roommate and bought a house I could barely afford in a worse neighborhood than what I wanted and a smaller house than what I wanted to buy. And I think I paid $230,000 for that house, roughly. I just Zillowed that house. Guess what the Zestimate is on that house? $384,000. So almost the $400,000 house. So it's just a matter of making, in a lot of cases, making sacrifices that you may not want to make. And whether or not that includes a longer mortgage, I don't know. I'm kind of wishy-washy on that one. But the fact is, you can't always get what you want. Like, it's not as simple as houses are unaffordable.
You would expect me to say, but you can try sometime.
Yeah, get what you want or get what you need. But yeah, it's just, I think there's just so much that goes into this conversation that when people are complaining about it, I was complaining about it back then too. This is, that was 20 something years ago. I mean, this is not a new problem. This has always been a problem for people in their 20s to afford a house. Maybe it's probably worse today, but also, where are you choosing to live? What are you trying to buy? What do you think you need to be comfortable?
And are you willing to get a second job
or a roommate?
Exactly.
So all of these things factor in, and I just don't think it's a completely apples to apples comparison when you look at what your parents and grandparents did.
Yeah.
If we were advising an individual in our office, we would go through all the options. What I don't like is all these people say, no, you can't offer that option. And thereby they're cutting out some of the people who might be able to leverage that in. And for a lot of young people, it's a really high priority. And one of the things that they ought to think about is where equity comes from. It comes from the clock, not from the wallet.
I agree with that. The 30-year thing, it seems to me like at least part of the design of 30-year being the timeline is that relates to the length of a career for a lot of people. And
of course,
to your point that the 7-year turnover, obviously that's the average. Nobody stays in their home. Very few people stay in their home 30 years. But no. Starting a clock with 50 years when you're 20, let's say you're 22, you come out swinging, you get a house, 50-year mortgage. 72 years old when you're done, 2 years into Social Security payments. I mean, that's just, at some point, every one of those buyers is going to have to accelerate payments.
I contend that most people who buy a house, not for the first time, I'm talking about repeat owners. Mm-hmm. Most repeat owners who buy a house in their, let's say, 40s, later, 35, 45 years old, whatever, they're probably not at that point where this will be their forever house. Most people that are buying then have kind of maximum need or want or both. And they'll stay there for a while, but by when they get close to retirement, it's probably not going to be the biggest deal in the world to pay that off because they're probably going to downsize. So why worry?
Mr. Beechler, our good friend, just sent me this text. 1950, average house, 1,200 square feet, six-person average family size. 2025, average square foot, 2,500, four-person average family size. So, again, have expectations changed a lot?
A lot.
It sure seems like it.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about the way we all grew up. You know, you were really something if you had a 1.5 bathrooms in your house.
Yeah, definitely. Back
two
in the day,
was unheard of.
Yep.
A lot of them were simply you had a bathroom and three bedrooms.
You had a powder room downstairs and a one bathroom upstairs.
That's
shared it.
That was pretty typical.
Yep.
I grew up with powder room downstairs and a full bath upstairs. Mm-hmm. So did Sarah. So that was pretty much America in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, that's how it was done.
My big beef is the people just shooting their mouth off and trying to deny things for other people because they're so smart that they know that it's going to cause them to not pay as much down or something. I say, come on, people. This country is built on choice, and it better stay built on choice. That's my complaint. All right, a couple quick things. The Medicare premiums came out yesterday while nobody was watching. Really lovely news in here. He lied. The A, which is most people get free, this is just deductibles for things like the inpatient hospital deductible, 3.58% for those. not totally unreasonable. That one really didn't bother me much. Now, Medicare B coverage went up a little. How about $202.90 starting January, an increase of $17.90 from the $185 we're paying today? That's a tiny little 9.68% increase.
Right on the inflation number from 3 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, the deductible will be $283, an increase of $26 from this year at $257.
Also about 9%.
10.16. All right, let's see. Irma, our favorite subject around this table. Irma increases. That's where you pay extra based on your income. So Irma is an income tax and nothing but, and you cannot get out of it if you're still earning that kind of money. So Irma, if you make more than $109,000, they, let's go 218 because it's joint, up 9.73%. Go up to the next one, it's up 9.68%. The next bracket, 9.7%. One after that, 9.7%. The one after that, 9.7%. So you get a little bump in the bracket and then a huge bump on the cost. That's after 9.7. Now, I got my Blue Cross bill. I've got a Blue Cross supplement. Just got it this week. The numbers are out. 17% increase. But no worries. I'm getting a 2.8% increase from my Social Security.
Ooh, lucky you.
Yeah. Part D, drug coverage under Medicare. You get to pay Irma on that even if you don't subscribe. This is one of the most egregious things. I've been complaining about this since I learned about it, probably about the time that we started this program close to 11 years ago. So you get to pay in Irma this next year, the from 1370 goes to 1450. Those kind of small numbers, right? But you didn't get anything. This the next bracket goes up from 35 to 37. Next one from 57 to 60. And then if you happen to be doing pretty well, you get to pay 8330. And remember, that's not couples pricing. That's individual pricing. So if there's two of you, you get to double that. And that is nothing but an income tax. It is absolutely disgusting, and I am about as irritated with the federal government as I've ever been.
But on the good side, we got to go through the upped contribution limits for IRAs and 401ks.
Yes, and I've got those right here.
Yeah, because that was good news.
Yeah, it was good news. They actually did raise some things, and I don't think we got enough time to really cover it, but suffice it to say, you get an extra $1,000 for your 401k. You get an extra $500 for your catch-up contributions for IRAs. IRAs went up from $7 to $7,500. All in all, yeah, and you should start right away doing your tax planning based on this. So if you're contributing to a 401k, you want to get that set up to take advantage of the bump starting in January. So yep, get it evenly along the way. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do an IRA contribution, always try to do it earlier in the year. You get an extra year of free growth in there. There's some changes on the Roth that I'm postponing until next week. That there's some things about the Roth contribution that really upset me, and I'll set you all straight next year. Well, thanks for listening. Sorry we've got to run, but we'll be here same time next week and full of it again. This is the Van